Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. On this very special edition of Inside the Asperger Studios, I'm talking with a defense attorney who found his client innocent of the crime of murdering his wife. Now, how this all ties in with autism is his client later in life was diagnosed with autism, and now my guest is on a mission to make it so that people don't quit.
I want to believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking, bottle up my intuition till it's popping out the box that I don't fit in.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today, I'm joined with McCracken Poston Jr., who is a defense attorney. Welcome to the show, McCracken.
Thank you so much, Reed. This is wonderful. This is kind of put together at the last minute by my publisher and media representative, and it's exactly the type of podcast I've been wanting to be on. Right. True crime will only carry you so far, but this is the real meat of the issue of the case that I wrote about. My book is Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. I'm the author, McCracken Poston Jr., but I was also the lawyer in the case. And where it fits in with your show is that my client and I had a great deal of difficulty. We, over 15 months of me advising him and then actually legally representing him, we had so many conflicts and misunderstandings, and we figured out a way to accommodate each other, to try to trust each other. And we won the case. He was accused of keeping his wife captive in a basement for 3 decades before killing her. Well, only 3 years ago did a juror in the case who had become a nurse reach out to me through a third party and suggested that Alvin Ridley may be autistic. He may be on the autism spectrum. Well, in 1997, 98, 99, when this case happened, nobody was talking about adult autism. The spectrum had only recently been put forward as classifying as autism as a wide spectrum of processing issues. And but just nobody was talking about adults. And when the juror suggested that, it was almost as if the blinders, were opened, and suddenly I could see, and I was thinking back of all the conflicts that we had. I was thinking back of all the things the state were using against him were autistic mannerisms, or autism mannerisms, probably the more proper way to say it. His flat vocal effect when he was calling in the 911 call, the misalignment in their view of the moment and his emotional reaction to the moment, and a number of things. He was very litigious. He seemed to hold a lot of grudges and resentments if anybody had ever done him wrong. Even as a child, he carried that into adulthood. And those kind of things that, unfortunately, for a millennium, probably, we have just chalked up to eccentricity. And that was just kind of the huge category. Well, because of Alvin's diagnosis, and it's interesting, we talked a little before the recording about how literal a person with autism can be. Alvin wanted me to be with him when he met the evaluator. She asked a couple of questions and wanted his reaction to them. One was the expression, "She's gotten under your skin." Well, he shuddered at that thought. Because literally somebody getting under your skin, that sounds extremely painful and almost a horror movie fodder. And the next one was, statement was, "He wears his heart on his sleeve." Well, Alvin was excited about that one. He said, "I know, he has an artificial heart." Well, it was funny because I have an insulin pump. And I always kind of derisively, self-depreciatingly say, "I've got a pancreas in my pocket," because that's what's supplying me insulin. No longer my original component, but this mechanical insulin pump. So I think Alvin was taking a lead from that when he heard "he wears his heart on his sleeve."
That's so funny that she used that one line, because in the autism community, when someone says they wear their heart on their sleeves, it's almost so true to being autistic, because all our emotions we carry on our sleeves. We people say we lack empathy, but it's really all our emotions are out there for everyone to see, because we just show it to everyone. We fear nothing.
Tell me this, something I've noticed about Alvin, who's been very open about his autism. I'm not talking out of school about him. He allowed me to announce the discovery, and it's been amazing how our community has warmed up to him. Mm-hmm. It's like they understand him now. And because of that warmth, he's expressing and exhibiting more warmth toward people. So it's an amazing thing how these misunderstandings can kind of accumulate on both sides of the fence. But I'm interested because Alvin will, for example, when my parents died, and he liked my parents, and he's particularly my father, I had the immediate reaction when each parent died, and I noticed Alvin just was kind of blank about it. And then about a week later, he was inconsolable about each of my parents when they passed. And so I've heard that there's sometimes an absorption of emotion from others. Mm-hmm. And then there's later a release. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be what I was experiencing with him.
Yeah, that is true. That does happen. I mean, that happened with me. I mean, my father died in 2017 and I didn't cry at all at the funeral. And I thought there was something wrong with me. And then all of a sudden later, I just broke down.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I lost my dog and I would have like these emotional like breakdowns of just crying, missing her. And it's because what's happening is all this emotion and all these memories are coming back and you're just getting flooded with it.
Mm. Well, let me tell you what Alvin's superpower was. He was a hell of a TV repairman. And he was so good at it in the old picture tube days, mm-hmm. that he was renowned and he was very reasonable. And that's one of the ways my father became friends with him. And he was our TV guy. And that's in the day, and young people won't realize it, but in the day, a TV was a huge investment. And it was almost furniture. It came in these beautiful wooden console boxes that looked like furniture. And when it broke down, it was too big to haul back and forth in your car. So you had a TV repairman come out and change a picture tube or make adjustments here or there. And Alvin was very successful at that. What I think very possibly happened was that the technology changed to solid state circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
And Alvin was not trained for that or prepared for that. And then suddenly we entered a world where people are buying much cheaper TVs. And when they break, even Walmart doesn't want you to bring them back. They just say, take them to the curb.
Yep.
You know, toss them in the trash. And
yeah, we're in the days where people are just buying. They're just like, you can buy a brand new one for $200.
Yeah.
They're not like what in the old days where TVs cost $300, $400, $500, $600.
Easily. And then, so that kind of happened, Alvin, around the time that a number of other ills happened, his father's death. And Alvin wrongfully connected his father's death from pancreatic cancer to a relatively minor car accident from a couple of years before. And in his kind of what I always call the Rube Goldberg causation diagram, he indicated that that's what killed his father was that car wreck. And sometimes it would just be, well, the county worried. He was very much in a private war with local government. But he also had a countermeasure of hope and trust in the federal government. And I thought it was so interesting, a kind of a dichotomy of how he interpreted and handled those two different levels of government. And it was almost like these feds, they're not going to be so local and tied up in the local, you know, influence pool. So they'll be above that. And as it turned out, his wife was very much like him in that regard. They both felt that the federal government was their salvation, which led to some fairly comedic situations during the representation. Alvin bolted from the courtroom one day. I was picking jury for another case, but it was the same jury pool for our case. And I wanted Alvin to sit there and just look at faces and, you know, write a name down if he remembers doing business with them, you know, selling them a TV or something like that, because his TV reputation was so good. Anybody that ever dealt with him in that world, I wanted them to be a juror. But Alvin fled the courtroom and drove almost an hour away to a federal courthouse, gave the bum's rush to the U.S. Marshals and ran through. They thought he had doused himself with gasoline. In fact, his car had kind of broken down on the way down, and he got in the carburetor and got fumes on him. And, you know, I just could not understand why he did that. And he went into the federal judge's office to complain about me, his lawyer. So I convinced them to let him go. Now, you can imagine, had that happened after 9/11.
Oh, my God.
They would have probably
been locked up.
They would have probably taken him down right there as a threat. So we were very fortunate to dodge that one. But there were other instances where Alvin would reach out to the federal government. There was just this interesting thought process that he could trust them, but he couldn't trust anybody locally.
How was he with, like, facial recognition? Was he able to recognize emotions from somebody that he's talking to just by looking at their face?
I don't think so. And I got to tell you, Reed, I was part of the problem, because I was very frustrated with him. And I realize now that I was part of the problem. My impatience, my inability to process his cues. Now I can, and we are very close friends. He does have some sensory issues. He does not like the feel of water on him.
That's interesting.
And that creates, obviously, some social problems. And I got frustrated with him, some of the ways he would be second-guessing me a lot. And I kind of lashed out at him. And I immediately felt something in me made me realize you probably shouldn't mention hygiene because he may not can help this. And I didn't identify it as autism, but I just thought he may not can help this. And I immediately wanted to take back what I said. Well, he seemed to not really process it at all. But within 30 or 48 hours, I had a skunk in my office that sprayed everything, the files, me, everything. And it was in the register, in the air conditioning register. And my client got to complain about how I smelled for a couple of days.
I know that feeling.
So it made me realize that, you know, we can't always help our circumstances.
Yeah, I know that feeling. I mean, a skunk smell, oh my God. When we lived in the north side, a skunk got into our backyards. And at the time we had two pugs, my black pug, anytime it smelled it, would want to go into the yard and go after him. Oh, and he got skunked twice. And the first time he came running into the house, stunk up the whole house.
Oh,
and
gosh.
When you get that smell and taste in your mouth, it's like, oh my God.
It's one of nature's greatest defensive things. Did you put tomato juice on him?
No, I forgot what we used. I think we read somewhere you can use Dove soap and something.
Oh gosh.
We washed him down thoroughly. And we thought he learned his lesson. Nope. Second time he went after him, got skunked again. But this time I was smart. I locked him in our laundry room, which has a door that leads out into the main house. So I immediately called upstairs to my parents. I'm like, Ralph got skunked again. We better get something and get him washed up soon.
Ralph got skunked. That'd be a great t-shirt.
Yep. So I'm pretty aware of that smell of skunk.
When did you learn of your Asperger's?
That's a long story, but I knew I was autistic. My parents knew I was autistic in my mid-20s. My PCP, my family, I had a mother, two of my mother's cousins were one was a psychologist, one was a college psychiatrist, and one was a family lawyer, all told my parents that I was exhibiting signs of autism. So then I was unofficially diagnosed. I was officially diagnosed in my 50s when I'd come across a clinical trial for a drug for autism, for communication skills, to help with communications. I went on this, I applied for it, and the first thing you had to do was go for the official diagnosis. So they separated me and my mother, and they asked us different questions about each other, about me and stuff, and that's when they officially diagnosed me.
That's fantastic. Now, do you find, like my friend Alvin, the subject of my book, he had this incredible focus on electronics, old electronics. Do you find yourself having almost a laser focus on some issues or interests?
Mm-hmm. Mine would mainly be computers.
Isn't that amazing?
In the hardware sense. My father was a computer person, and he always used to say to me, I don't know how you could be into computers if you don't understand programming and logic. I'm like, well, Dad, there's two sides to a computer. There's either the programming side, and then there's the hardware side. I'm the hardware person. I'm the person you call when your network card craps out, when your motherboard craps out, and you need one replaced. I'm that kind of a person.
Mm-hmm. And he's the other type. He's
My
on the other side of that coin.
He was both.
Oh, wow.
He understood programming and never understood how I never understood it. And I'm like, I just never understood logic at all. And that's one of my autistic problems is logic. A lot of times I don't understand how things go. And I just don't get it. And my parents don't understand why either. but
well,
programming course.
You're free from the constraints of logic as well. So it allows you to think more freely.
It does. I remember I had a job interview, and as the guy was looking at my resume, he goes, "Oh, you're a web designer and an IT tech. You think analytically and you think logically." I'm like, "Yeah, I think." No, he's like, "You think abstract and linear." I'm like, "Yeah, I do, because I see both sides."
That's fantastic. Now, see, I call that a superpower.
Yeah. And I also have 2 degrees on both ends of the computer industry.
Really?
Yeah. My bachelor's is in IT. My master's is in CS, computer science.
Now, do you apply those vocationally? I mean, all I know you from is from this podcast. So I didn't know that if you're just not a full-time podcaster or not.
I am a full-time podcaster. I wish I could apply my skills, but because of the fact I have ADHD as well, if you don't use it, you lose it.
I get it.
Everything from college is gone.
Well, and it's a technology that, what do they say, doubles every so often.
Yeah.
And I get it. But I think you have a lot to offer. Definitely with this podcast, because I was very excited to be able to come on and talk to you about my autistic friend. And the book has a lot of our frustrations, my frustrations, and his frustrations with me. And last night, we both appeared at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library in Atlanta. And we described our case and some of the bigger frustrations that everyone had. Well, knowing now that it was him being on the spectrum, it's a cautionary tale, as well as it's a story of friendship, because we became friends. He's like a big brother. He's that much older than me. He's about 17 years older than me. And he was in high school with my oldest sister, actually.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting, because and I'm hoping that our friendship, because I have it much easier than he does in our community, because of what I do and how long I've been doing it. And I'll be 65 this year. And so I've reached a level in the community that now I think I can help him with that my position in the local society is making everybody understand my friend Alvin.
Mm-hmm.
And this book hopefully accomplishes that. When we came out of the courthouse, after the acquittal, I didn't know what I was going to say, but I walked out the front door and here's all this press and a crowd out in the courthouse lawn. And those courthouse steps meant so much to me, because I had received the outcomes of all the elections. I used to hold public elective office in the state legislature. And then I lost my last race, the congressional race for U.S. Congress there. But even Alvin had run for sheriff back in 1984. And it was part of his being a gadfly and being mad at everybody that he just decides, "I'm going to take out the sheriff," you know. And I'll never forget, because he was running out of anger, unfortunately. There were a lot of people ready to tease him and taunt him and kind of heckle him. And I was 24. I was 4 years away from running for office myself for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of wanted to watch. I wanted to watch this spectacle of this angry, failed TV repairman, you know, going off on a rant against the sheriff. And he brought with him to the stand on the courthouse steps a cassette player. And the crowd was kind of just waiting, you know, to, I'm sure, ridicule him or, you know, boo him or whatever. And he turns on the cassette player and holds it up to the microphone. And do you remember, or you may not be old enough to remember this, but TV used to go off about 1 a.m.
Yeah, I remember those days.
And this was the sign-off for the local Chattanooga CBS affiliate that had a well-known anchors and radio voice, you know, saying goodnight, and that WDEF was signing off, and then it played the national anthem. Well, he played the national anthem for the first part of his speech. But you know what? It made the crowd that were ready there to heckle him or just be bored by him or whatever their intentions were in the middle of all these long speeches, everybody stood up and took off their caps. And I thought, this guy's pretty smart. At the very least, he has a fresh audience. Yeah. If they've got their blood circulating. They stood up. They took off their hats. They got quiet. And then, you know, he gave a couple of minutes of talk that, you know, was, again, one of those Rube Goldberg diagrams of causation of all of his ills. But I always admired the way he handled that.
I mean, that kind of reminds me of why people are quick to point. I mean, they were all ready to point fingers at him. Why do you assume people are so quick to point their fingers at us or anyone who's got a mental disorder?
Well, I don't know the answer why, but I know with Alvin, he had been very litigious. So he had gone after a number of public local officials in the courts. So he didn't make a lot of friends there. Mm-hmm. And then when confronted with his wife's death, he was very open. He let law enforcement in his house. He wouldn't let me in his house for over a year, but he let anybody with a badge in his house, and he spoke freely. And one of the investigators used a tape recorder surreptitiously while three other officers were questioning him. Mm-hmm. And he didn't let them know that he was taping. So it became discoverable for me to get, and the state wasn't going to use it because they were using methods that have been approved by the U.S. Supreme Court. It is okay, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, for an officer to lie to you, to trick you into a confession.
Isn't that impeachment? Not impeachment, encroachment or?
No, it's allowed.
Huh.
And so these officers were.
Entrapment, that's the word.
Yeah, these officers were, you know, one of them said, you know, I don't believe you hurt your wife. And I thought, that's beautiful. I'm not going to say he was trying to entrap my client. I'm going to say even the sheriff's department can't agree on whether he's guilty or not. So how could you find him guilty? That was my argument. But at the same time, you to answer your question, I think if everybody just doesn't consider neurodiversity when you're interacting with another person and you are expecting them to use the same glossary, the same phraseology, the same rules of communication that you use, then you're going to be frustrated with some people. And those are going to be the neurodiverse people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are not processing your questions well. And so when someone who is not neurodiverse is getting the responses back that they're getting, they're they're very quick to jump to the conclusion that this person is being elusive, or this person is being refuses to answer our questions. And so we need more training. We need more training for people who are being interrogated. They need to try to rule out, could this person be neurodiverse? Could this be the reason why they have a flat vocal effect? And their emotions don't seem to be where the investigator thinks they should be. And as you know, even I would say across humanity, people handle emotions differently. And I don't think anybody should ever be judged by their immediate reaction to the loss of a loved one, because sometimes they're in shock. And sometimes they could be neurodiverse and they're just trying to process it. It's too much. But again, I would get ahead of myself. Alvin at the last minute decided to take the stand. This is the Bible Belt of the South. And I think to make me feel better about it, Alvin said that Jesus appeared to him and told him to testify. So he knew that was somebody I couldn't overrule. And so he had the right to testify. And I told him that. I said, you know, that's only your right to choose. And I can't, even if I did not want you to, you still can. Or if I wanted to put you on the stand and you did not want to go, that's also your call. And you are the one that gets to decide that, not me. So in any event, he did quite well. And to my surprise, I think to the juror's surprise, he was quite good. But of course, when the DA started cross-examining him, I kind of chuckled to myself because he was now in the trap that I had been in for 15 months, trying to have a dialogue with this guy that you'd forget that you have to be extremely literal.
Yes.
And even on redirect, when he had done so well, I was so proud of him, but I messed up. I said, please tell the jurors what you lost. And I was wanting him to say, from the heart, I wanted him to say, the best friend I ever had, the love of my life. But very literally, he took my question and said, oh, I guess the funeral bill. And the DA, oh man, the DA went crazy on that. Listen to how, you know, basically he inferred that my client was cold and heartless, that's all this death meant to him was a funeral bill. And of course, I knew better than that.
So you feel if he was diagnosed earlier in time, things would have gone a different way?
Well, I think that maybe he wouldn't have had to stand trial. You know, and that's what I would have hoped would happen if there were a situation where people were, those diagnoses were known. And once somebody became a suspect, perhaps a family member or somebody could say, oh, by the way, he has autism. You need to adjust your questioning, and you don't need to jump to conclusions about his mannerisms or his, you know, flat tone or the fact that his emotions aren't where you think they should be. And that I think that's the best we could do, is just training the professionals who can just give that benefit of the doubt to a person who has those issues and not utilize the mannerisms as evidence of guilt.
Now, do you feel if you had somebody in the courtroom who understood autism, it would have helped that case, your case?
Well, we won the case, but we might have won it easier because I could explain Alvin's, you know, mannerisms and flat effect and those kind of things.
What was the winning notion that helped you win the case?
Well, it was Alvin's insistence on testifying. Now, he did everything that I would wake up worrying about in the middle of the night. He wanted to talk about all this ancient civil litigation that had all been dismissed, but he kept it all active in his mind. And you know what? Part of the juror's knowledge of him, knowing how obsessed he was with this kind of stuff, he got to tell them. The Atlanta newspaper reporter, after watching the trial, he wrote, "Alvin Ridley finally took the witness stand that he's been trying to get in for 30 years." And that's because none of his civil litigation ever made it to the end, to, you know. So it was a wonderful outcome, but it was a very difficult journey. And I would not wish that journey on anyone because of, you know, there was a tabloid newspaper, the supermarket tabloid, that came out with the headline, "Sicko holds wife captive 30 years and then kills her." And just the jumping to the conclusion that he of his guilt. And that kind of was a boxing in to him in the community. He felt that the community was turning against him even more so. And, you know, as you know, you can have multiple diagnoses. Alvin was a little paranoid, and that was found in the state psychologist's evaluation of him. Interestingly enough, he doesn't seem that way anymore. You know, he's a very pleasant man. He's very kind to people. Very has always been very deferring to if a lady is in the room. He's, you know, polite. He gives them his seat. He's old fashioned in that way. But I'm excited because tomorrow night in the city of Ringgold, the Ringgold Youth Council, which is a bunch of high school and college students who kind of are learning about government, they are holding a book event for in Ringgold. And this is the town where he thought everybody was after him and tormenting him. And now they're honoring him.
Oh, good for him.
And I think it's wonderful, you know, the young people are calling him a living legend because he's been on all these TV shows and he's very solid with his demeanor and, you know, the story never changes about how his wife died of a seizure and he was accused of murdering her.
Why did they think he was holding her hostage?
Because she did not leave the house for 27 years. But let me tell you, I found those writings. She left writings behind, and Alvin was making a shrine to her on one of his walls when he finally let me into his house. Her writings, we later learned, literally on the eve of putting my epilepsy expert on the stand, we learned that those writings were from something called hypergraphia, a condition that compelled her to write. It didn't direct what she wrote. It just compelled her to write what was on her mind. And I estimated that we found 15,000 entries.
Wow.
But I just couldn't use all of them. So I spent about 3 or 4 days going through. And Alvin's status of living declined once his wife was gone. The house became more and more cluttered. There were vermin in the house, a lot of cockroaches and rodents. And Unfortunately, because Alvin would not let me keep the evidence, he brought the evidence into the courtroom every day in two old suitcases, in which we infested the first courtroom with roaches from the suitcases. The judge made us move the trial to an old courthouse building where an old 1939, very grand, large courtroom. And that happened to be the last place Virginia Ridley had ever been seen in public alive. And that was eerie, putting together her writings in this place. And I've told some other podcaster, I'm not a ghost person. I'm not a person that sees a ghost around every corner, but it was eerie. And it was, I felt like we belonged in that courtroom, because that courtroom still had the memory of her.
Mm-hmm.
The day that they fought their eviction and in 1970, the judge ordered her to be brought forward. Her parents were in the room because they had been seeking her. She had kind of disappeared for a couple of years. And they left, I guess, satisfied that she did not want to go home with them, and she did not want them hounding her anymore. And her parents pretty much left her alone. But 27 years later, with her parents either dead or institutionalized in a facility, assisted living facility, her sisters took up the mantle of she's been held against her will. And yeah, it was all rumor based, but I kind of get it. I mean, I have five sisters. If one completely disappeared with some man, I'd be a pain in his side, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, what made you take up Alvin's case?
It's interesting. I just lost a congressional race.
Mm-hmm.
My father encouraged me to help Alvin. Alvin and I just started meeting on the street, and what I later determined was he was seeking me out.
Oh.
Because it was the same intersection we would cross every day, and I realized this is by design. And I started to speak to him, and he kind of lashed out, but he knew I was listening. And probably because of my father, I kept listening. But I had just been defeated in a congressional race. And at some point, Alvin was sitting in my office, and my former opponent, the U.S. congressman, called. And my secretary gave me the number very, out loud in front of Alvin, and said the U.S. congressman had called. Well, Alvin kind of got excited, and, and I thought, he thinks this call's about him, you know. That's just how this guy thinks. He's always thinks the federal government calls are about him. Well, the call was about him. The congressman told me to keep Alvin Ridley away from his congressional offices, that he was frightening the ladies that worked there. Well, Alvin would go in seeking redress. He would seek, help from he would petition his federal government for help. Now, his legal theories were flawed, but he was very sincere about it, that they should help him, and they should take over this case that his lawyer's not knocking out, in sufficient time. And so I told Alvin that I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I told him that the congressman was complaining about both of us. And I told him that the congressman said if either one of us showed up at his congressional office, he's going to have us both arrested. And I said, Alvin, please don't get me arrested. I can't help you if I get arrested because of something you do. And I don't want to go there because I don't want you to get arrested for something I do. But I did tell him this, and I kind of enjoyed telling him this. I said, if you'll just cooperate and help me help you and actually help me work on your murder case, when this is over, I'll take you and show you where he lives. And that satisfied him. Now, since then, our congressman became our governor, And our governor did some wonderful things for people who have criminal convictions. He really made life attainable for them again, a life of work and good works. And so I say in the book at the end that because the governor did that, my former opponent, the congressman, I never told Alvin where he lived.
Now, what took so long for Alvin to get diagnosed?
Well, we ended the case. We did a 2 or 3 years of TV shows. We gave the story away to anybody who would listen, but I could not explain Alvin, and that was the frustrating thing about it. But I still didn't recognize myself autism. I didn't know enough about it, and so it was. I just thought, well, there's Alvin. That's the way he is. You know, he still doesn't quite trust anybody in the world. And so we were doing another podcast, and this podcaster contacted that juror from his case, who was now a nurse in Alaska. And she had worked and been around enough autistic people that they reminded her of Alvin. And so she reached out through the podcaster to me and said, you know, please ask Mr. Poston, have you ever encouraged Alvin to be diagnosed to see if he has autism? And so it made all the sense in the world to me, because suddenly now I had 20 more years of experience with people who, young people who, I knew had autism, and it started making a lot of sense. And so that's when with Alvin's permission, I took him, I paid for the evaluation. And the discovery of it really formed finally the book in my head. That wasn't the reason I did it. I did it so that possibly he might even get greater disability benefits. And that's where he was interested in it. Alvin's very transactional.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that. And I learned that is somewhat of a autistic trait. It turned out that when my parents, the kindness of my parents to send a Thanksgiving plate to his house by me, that kindness caused him to open up the door and let me and invite me into his house. And that's that day is where I discovered all of his wife's writings, and it turned the case.
So what got you into the world of autism then?
Alvin Ridley.
That's very interesting.
Now I have another client who's a younger man who is autistic, was beloved student at his high school. He had this uncanny focus and ability to do very difficult basketball shots. He was not on the team. He was kind of a beloved, you know, helper of the basketball team. So I don't know why. I don't know if he was just not able to work as a team member, but he could do these incredible individual shots. And he would do exhibitions during pep rallies where he would go out and be sinking half-court shots just one after another, just from pretty much any location he could sink it. And so he's very much beloved. Well, he also has some type of seizure disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a seizure. His grandmother called for an ambulance. A lot of times first responders are law enforcement, and they totally misinterpreted him coming out of that seizure. And he ended up with a felony obstruction charges. And that's kind of the go-to charge when an officer is dealing with a person exhibiting autistic mannerisms where they're not answering questions directly. It escalates. And before you know it, there's physical activity, and the suspect, you know, they push back. They don't understand why they're being suddenly pushed and asked to turn around and put their wrists together, you know, and so there can be a reaction that I don't think we should hold that person to the same standards of a neurotypical person who's asked to turn around and put their hands behind their back, you know, if that makes any sense.
It does. I mean, I personally think not only do the law enforcement need to be trained on what neurodivergent people are, but I also think the people in the courts need to be trained.
Absolutely. Judges need to be trained.
Yeah, because you're going to mistake a meltdown for a tantrum.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be held contempt.
Absolutely. I've seen it happen. Reed, tell me about your audience.
My audience is a lot of autistics from all over the world. I've gotten lots of positive reviews and remarks from people, starting from my blog I started with, and it's just a very big positive audience.
So what all countries have you reached?
England, Australia. I actually talked to the assistant minister of autism in Australia.
Wow, they have that.
Yeah, she's the first of their kind out there.
Wow.
And one of the things we talked about is the fact that how they're more centric with helping those who are autistic.
Well, that would be a wonderful place for our country and our culture to learn from. And I love seeing that other countries are ahead of us on that, because that may be the proving ground.
Yeah.
For our, I hope that my book appeals to not only a person on the spectrum, if they like to read, but if their family members like to read, because their family members are going to be frustrated that I'm not getting it throughout the story until the very end.
Yeah.
Because they live with their loved one and they get it. They're going to recognize Alvin's mannerisms and traits as autism, you know, years before I knew. But I wanted to tell the story straight. I wanted to tell them, you know, my frustrations at the time.
I mean, that's funny, because when I was in school, after I graduated, I was talking with a friend of mine that I met at school, and one out of the blue, she goes, "Can I ask you a personal question?" And I'm like, "Sure." She goes, "Are you autistic?" And I was kind of taken back, and I'm like, "Yeah, why?" She's like, "Well, you exhibit a lot of the traits." I'm like, "How would you know?" She's like, "Well, I'm in the psychology program, and I work with a lot of younger children that are autistic, and you exhibit a lot of those traits that they have as well."
Isn't that amazing? So say that's what I'm hoping that your readers will find in this book. And I certainly tried to, my client has a lot of dignity about him, even though he doesn't like to bathe. He has this feeling that he's you know, the world is, he did at the time felt the world was against him and that he was impoverished. And I got him on disability and I got him on Social Security. So he's comfortable. When his car breaks down, we'll go and help him find another car and help him negotiate it, you know, so that he's not in any disadvantage. And he loves his independence, and I'm just hoping and praying that he can stay independent a long time. And last night, in front of the crowd at the Carter Center, he is threatening to live to 110 so that he can have 28 more years of lunches with me. And that's a compliment. And I would love for that to happen, because that means I'm going to make it to 92.
So let's talk a little bit about your friendship with him. I mean, you got him off this trial, and then did your friendship just started to blossom?
Huh. Well, it's one that, you know, I recognize that he was always, and I think possibly just in our region, which is not necessarily the fastest to adapt to medical trends and discoveries, I worried that he may always need someone to help him navigate this neurotypical structure. And my secretary, I have to give her, she's been my secretary for 15 years. And the last 15 years, she has so greatly contributed to Alvin's quality of life. Before she worked as my legal secretary, she worked with developmentally disabled and affected adults. So she just has the right touch. And you know, occasionally Alvin will act out on some issues where he will get frustrated and he'll say, well, I'm moving away from town. And I used to take those threats seriously. I thought, where in the world will he go? And this is going to be awful if he moves out of town, and because he won't know what to do. And, you know, he's just basically, he's, you know, it's the equivalent today of the meltdowns that he used to have. So it's just frustration. So I try to just talk him through it and explain to him. We used to pray a lot during the representation. And quite frankly, I was utilizing prayer to give him legal advice, because it was only when he thought I was praying that he wouldn't be screaming at me. So I would, you know, just by accident, one day he started yelling about his van being taken again, like 14 years before the case that I was representing him on. And I just said, oh Lord, you know, like, here we go again. But he thought I was starting a prayer. And so he went immediately silent, bowed his head, and was ready for me to complete the prayer. So I completed the prayer with all the legal advice I could cram into a prayer. And But I'll tell you, Reed, by the time we got to the trial and he did such a good job testifying, I was really praying. I was really praying after that, because I thought, did I do enough for this guy? You know, I really believe in his innocence, and I don't know if I was able to do enough for him. And of course, the outcome was good. So over the years, there was a period of time that he got a new girlfriend who was a very odd person. She did not like lawyers or preachers.
Huh.
And she kept Alvin away from both. And so, and Alvin's a guy who likes to go to church, but for 6 years, he didn't. Well, he got taken advantage of in a scam, a telephone scam. And he came to me, and I knew it took a lot for him to come to me, but he had lost the girlfriend, so that impediment wasn't there anymore. And he came to me, and it was as simple as going across the street and telling AT&T to change his phone number. And that kept the scammers from calling him. And so on that day, I said, Alvin, why don't we go have lunch? I'd like to catch up with you. And then, you know, while we're out, why don't we go both get our flu shots? You know, just something to kind of help you stay safe this winter. Well, then we went through the COVID stuff. And at that point, I was his only contact. And I think most of the time I am. But, you know, he does have a barber that he goes to regularly. And he goes, he loves certain restaurants. And so that's our gifts to him every Christmas, or a bunch of gift certificates for the restaurants that he likes. And I don't know. I think in I worry about him getting in the same kind of situation that he did when, you know, he basically exhibited enough traits that he was misinterpreted as being elusive and thought to be guilty of some pretty heinous stuff. So I would just say the battle of going through a battle with someone kind of bonds you.
Mm-hmm.
And that battle of that case really did bond us as friends. And so I'm happy to have an autistic friend. He fascinates me to no end. I have a great deal of respect for his intellect. He was right on so many things about his case. And that's my bailiwick. That's my things I should know better about. But he had better instincts than I did on his own case. So I really appreciate you having me. I hope that, like I said, I do express some of my frustration about the things about him that I did not understand. I certainly mean no disrespect to him. I was just very frustrated. And now, of course, I do understand it and do understand him. And I'm just very proud for considering my friend. And he's enjoying the notoriety. He's the kind of guy who is not shy. He signs books just like I do. And signs it right on the title page, Zenith Man. Because that was the kindest of names people gave him. As you know, in a small town, growing up in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, he got some pretty derisive name-calling going on there.
Yeah. He must have loved being on TV, being interviewed all over the place.
He really, he's very innocent in a lot of ways. He will come and tell me that he has a new girlfriend. I'll say, oh, really? Who is she? Well, I don't know her name yet, but it was a waitress or a server, I guess server, that's what they call him now, who was kind to him. And Alvin's can misinterpret those type of gestures. And I think as an older man reaching 82, he's now considered cute in his efforts to, you know, for love. You know, he's like a cute old man to these ladies now.
Now, with things the way they are, what do you hope to see changed in our American justice system?
Well, I would hope that any forensic evaluation of a defendant, which the lawyers will generally trigger that through request, and it's almost a self-preservation thing for the lawyer, because you don't want to walk somebody into a plea that has psychological problems that might affect their ability to understand the plea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think processing and the way you process information is critical to understanding things. So I think processing issues are something we just have to know about, so that we know that if there is a guilty plea, that person knew what they were doing, that they understood all the ramifications, and that they, you know, truly and freely entered that plea. So I'm just hoping that there is some change. I mean, if we save one autistic young man or woman from going through the type of thing that Alvin went through, or that the tons of examples that you and I both gave each other off the record,
mm-hmm.
From the news, those kind of things, if we can keep one of them from happening, it would be worth all the effort.
Yeah. Why do you think those of us on the spectrum are so misunderstood?
Well, it's It's not for lack of intellect. It's a processing issue. And the processing goes both ways. Because I was having problems processing Alvin Ridley in my way of thinking. It didn't make sense to me the way he was articulating or the positions he was taking. But to him, it made all the sense in the world, and I didn't make sense to him. And I hung with him because, again, my former opponent kind of, you know, threatened us, really threatened him, but I included myself in the threat to make it an easier news on him. But that kind of made me a little mad, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to show this guy. I'm going to help Alvin Ridley. You know, I'm going to do my best to help him. And Alvin just has a charm to him after you get to know him that you want to help him. Once you understand the reasons he takes certain positions, you get him, you know. But I really appreciate you having me. This is my third podcast today, and I have one more here in a few minutes.
All right. So then we'll end it with, where can people learn more about you and your book?
That is a wonderful. You're a good interviewer. I don't know. Is my screen backwards or is it front ways?
It's front ways.
Okay, good. To me, it's backwards. But this is the cover. It is Alvin and his young fiance at an amusement park in my community back in 1965. And it's a very romantic picture. It is from one of those photo booths where you get four pictures from the sitting. Mm-hmm. There's another picture on the inside of the book of them just, you know, smiling for the camera. I say that because there's more than one book with my title. Mm-hmm. The other book is a fictional account of our case that where they changed our names. And that's okay because, like I said, I gave the story away for a long time, and this person just picked it up and made some changes and wrote a book. I was upset at first, but in fact, she motivated me to finally write our book. Mm-hmm. So I really have to thank her, you know, for making me mad and making me know that if I didn't tell this story, somebody else is going to tell it. But I appreciate you having me read because I've learned a lot from you that I can apply to my friendship to Alvin and to my new client who has autism spectrum disorder and to future clients and maybe others. If I see it in court with another lawyer, I may go over and whisper to that lawyer, you know, you really should perhaps have that your client tested for autism because it could help explain so much about, as you said, this meltdown or, you know, the things that I had an obstruction case once where my client had some psychological disorders. It was not autism. It was, I think, schizophrenia. And the police officer training at that time, which was 20 years ago, indicated that if you had knowledge of any psychological condition, then you slow everything down. You safely encircled the person with as many officers as you can get there, but nobody makes any sudden moves. And you talk. You know, you talk and you kind of reason and talk and explain. Well, that didn't happen. You know, two or three officers came in on him hot. And next thing you know, there's a giant ball of dust with fists and knees coming out of it. And that's the classic cartoon image of a fight, as you may remember, the big ball of dust. And it was so obvious that they violated their own training. And that's what led to the obstruction. So we won. We won that trial by showing that they should have known, that they were informed that he had some issues, and they went in so hot, violating every bit of their training. So all we need is just another component of that training, and then the enforcement mechanisms of, you know, throwing a case out if they do wrong, you know, those kind of things.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Reed Miles. I was McCracken Poston, and I'll see you in the next one.